This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Dogbert's Top Secret Management Handbook by Scott Adams. This tape will teach you the Dogbert Management Method. All modern managers use this tape as their primary guide. When you finish this tape, you will know what they know. Leadership isn't something that you're born with. It's something you learn by listening to Dogbert tapes. Warning: if you are not a manager, turn this tape off right now. There are some things you're better off not knowing. If you are listening to this tape, it is either because you are a manager or because you are a curious little wanker who has ignored my earlier admonitions against listening this long. Let's say you're a manager, just for argument. You need to develop the distinctive mannerisms and practices that will distinguish you from the exploited masses. As any expert will tell you, there's no better source for this kind of information than a small white dog with glasses. That would be me. You should listen to me because my brain is much larger than yours. To illustrate my point, imagine that my brain is, for example, represented by the continent of Africa. Now imagine that your brain is represented by something very tiny. Let's say, for example, your brain. I think that you can see the contrast here. And if you can't, trust me, you're listening to the right tape. As a manager, you could do a lot of thinking, experimenting, and continuous training. Or you can just do what everyone else does and blindly follow my directions like an unthinking zombie. Blind obedience is easier than the alternatives, and the pay is the same. In fact, the pay is better if you look at it from an hourly perspective, so keep listening. The two paths of management. In an ideal world, your job as a manager would include setting goals and acquiring the resources to achieve them. But you don't live in an ideal world, largely because there are people like you in it. Since you don't have the authority to establish goals and acquire resources, you are left with only two logical choices. Alternative 1, do nothing. Result, get fired for doing nothing. Alternative 2, do irrational and unproductive things. Result, get rewarded for being a can-do manager who makes things happen. To make matters worse, you will be expected to spend as much as 40 hours every week doing management stuff, regardless of how much management is really needed. Obviously, unless things are seriously broken, most of what you do will be filler. Fortunately, there are many managerish things you can do to pack your schedule and make yourself look like a capable executive. Some management time fillers can include renaming the department, status reports, teamwork exercises, office relocations, writing mission statements, random organizational changes, making view graphs, and micromanagement. Now let's talk about manager language. It's not a good idea to refer to the dolts who report to you as dolts. It makes them more dangerous than they already are. Although it can be very entertaining to rile them up, it's not recommended. As a manager, you have to learn to be more diplomatic. Use the more acceptable term, resources. It means the same thing as dolt, but for some reason, it doesn't get the same reaction. Likewise, the terms team member or associate should be used instead of the diminutive terms pud and loser, respectively. The new terms sacrifice nothing in accuracy while doing much for your personal security. In this tape, I'll refer to the people who report to you as employees because the term encompasses all of those diminutive meanings. It's important that your employees think you are smart. Judging from the fact that you're listening to this tape, you'll probably have to fake it. Listen carefully to the zombie-like speech patterns of other managers and try to imitate them. If you hear a new management buzzword, jump on it like a starving squirrel on the last peanut on Earth. Now let's talk about the management zombie stare. Combine your new management language skills with the management zombie stare. Learn to hide every trace of comprehension and compassion in your expression. Your face should send this message: logic is futile. Some rookie managers make the mistake of inviting input from the employees, hoping for some valuable insight or contribution. As far as unwarranted optimism goes, this is roughly equivalent to panning for gold in your own shower. Here's a valuable tip. If your employees were capable of generating any nuggets of wisdom, they wouldn't be working for you. Now let's talk about looking like a manager. Clothes make the leader. Employees probably won't ever respect you as a person, but they might respect your clothes. Great leaders throughout history have understood this fact. Take the Pope, for example. If you took away his impressive Pope hat, his authority would be seriously diminished. Ask yourself if you would take advice on birth control from a guy wearing, let's say, a John Deere hat. I don't think so. You can learn from the Pope's example. Wear impressive clothes. This will be the primary source of your respect, if any, for the remainder of your career. And how about management personality? It will no longer be necessary to be witty or attractive in order for people to pay attention to you. As a manager, your power and charisma will carry you through any social situation. In fact, you can be physically repulsive and still have a good chance of bedding one of your attractive employees through the use of subtle intimidation. From a strict legal perspective, this is criminal behavior. But let's face it, you didn't become a manager so you could get the best parking space. You did it so you could talk dirty to attractive people who couldn't complain. Your jokes will also take on a new air of richness and humor, no matter how many times you tell the same ones. Your employees will feel obliged to laugh heartily, and if you mix in some sexual innuendos, that's the same as foreplay. Some people say you shouldn't abuse your power as a manager, but being timid is no way to live. Go out and grab some gusto, and if the gusto files a lawsuit, claim you are misinterpreted. Before you rise to power, you felt obliged to stop rambling when your listener showed signs of starvation, coma, or rigor mortis. That's all in the past. If you're part of a meeting that's scheduled for 60 minutes, feel free to use it all. And remember, agendas are suggestions, not rules, and rules were made to be broken. Therefore, suggestions are made to be ignored. That last statement didn't make any sense, but logic is not a luxury that a busy manager can afford. Sometimes you have to cut corners to make more time for babbling. Sometimes you'll blunder into a meeting where the person who called the meeting has a purpose or a mission for the meeting. That's the sort of thing they should be doing on their own time, not yours. Ignore their rudeness and proceed with your own good work. It is not necessary for you to understand the technology that drives your company, or even the technology that raises and lowers your big puffy chair. You are a manager, not a detail person, and you can pay the little people to do the boring technical work for you. However, there are a few key technical concepts you should master to avoid embarrassment. Number one, when you fax a piece of paper, your original piece of paper does not actually travel through the phone lines, nor can you save travel expenses by faxing yourself to a distant location. Number two, if your PC is plugged into the power outlet, that doesn't mean you're connected to the internet, despite all the hype you hear about how easy it is. You also need software. Number three, you don't need to move your desk or put on sneakers in order to be running under Windows. Number four, Ethernet will not make you lose consciousness even if you sniff a broken cable. About once a week, you should skim technical magazines, such as Newsweek or People, and ask your staff, "Why aren't we doing this?" Then watch them squirm as they try to convince you that it's impossible or hideously expensive. They are lazy and deceitful. Ignore their so-called expertise and demand that they do your bidding. Try to pick your technology challenges at random, as opposed to having some immediate relevance to work in progress. This shows the scope of your intellectual grasp of technology. For example, if your department is building a new customer database, insist that it incorporate the ability to store aromas and music, in case you need those capabilities later. If you're too lazy to skim technology magazines for good ideas, simply combine any two good concepts, then challenge your staff to make it happen. For example, you could say, "Why don't we make all of our electrical outlets digital?" Or, "Why don't we get some multimedia fax machines?" Prior to becoming a manager, you handled your own calendar. From now on, your schedule will be managed by a secretary whose goal is to send you to meetings that are far away from the office. To illustrate this point, let's say that your most important priority is to hire additional staff members to improve client service. Your secretary will respond by booking you on a mining expedition to the Axlon Nebula star system. This might not have much to do with your priorities, but the alternative is to make your own appointments, and that is not what leaders do. Leaders do what their secretaries schedule them to do. Take Napoleon Bonaparte, for example. He was originally an accounting manager in Paris, but his secretary handled the calendar, and she hated him because he had some sort of short guy personality disorder that had no name at the time. So his secretary would book him for things such as invade Russia during the winter and Waterloo, 2 p.m. Don't complain if your secretary sends you out of the office. The alternative is worse. If you've been a tyrant lately, your secretary will seek revenge by the idiot trickle torture. This involves filling your calendar with slow-talking, dim-witted employees who form a never-ending line outside your office door. You won't get a lot of work accomplished under this new scheduling system, but luckily, as a manager, your pay is not linked to the quantity of your work. Your pay depends on the appearance of work plus the intangible qualities you bring to the job, such as leadership and motivation, and you can pay other people to do that stuff for you. More good news? Intangible leadership qualities are difficult for anybody to actually notice. This is your passport to leisure. Nobody will really know if you're exuding huge quantities of leadership and motivation, or if you're just walking around bothering people. To the untrained observer, these activities are identical. So you can do whichever is easier, and it will have no impact on your pay. As a manager, you are no longer expected to be on time for any meeting with your underlings. They will entertain themselves by making small talk, so named because of the size of their paychecks. You can calculate the number of minutes to be late by multiplying the number of people in the meeting by 3 and then showing up whenever you feel like it. It's more of an art than a science. Tease your helplessly waiting underlings by walking briskly past the doorway with a document in your hand and saying something like, "I just have to make one phone call," then leave for the afternoon. They'll still be there in the morning, so there's no reason to make special efforts for people who don't know how to act empowered. They must learn to be independent. And how about those executive retreats? An executive retreat is a process where all the decision makers in your company go to a nice resort and ask themselves 2 questions. Number 1, how can we make the employees work harder for less money? And number 2, why is morale so low? Both problems are addressed by working on such things as mission and vision and guiding principles of the company. These activities might not seem directly related to the 2 questions, but the process is effective because it takes a long time, and the longer the executives are away, the higher the productivity and morale will be back at the office. Have you heard the term management physics? As a manager, you are automatically endowed with special powers to manipulate time, matter, and space. You can suspend the relationship between cause and effect and make time move at any rate you choose. This is handy more often than you might think. Your special powers can be useful when, for example, your lazy employees tell you that an important task will take at least 6 months to finish. And let's say you just told your boss that the task would take only 2 weeks. Solution? All you have to do is adjust the timeline down to 2 weeks. This seemingly simple change will cause a chain of events that will ripple through the fabric of space-time and result in an energy-free transfer of blame from you to your employees at approximately the speed of light. As a manager, you will also be able to control gravity. Sir Isaac Newton showed that dense objects, such as managers, have more gravity. Your office will become a black hole into which all employee input will be lost forever. No matter how many times your employees give you something, diskettes, documents, whatever, you can claim you never got it. Best of all, it's not your fault. It's the law of gravity. You might wonder how managers acquire these special powers. You've heard how sometimes a blind person develops good hearing. It's like that, except in this case, it's more like a blind person who acquires a limp. Here's what you need to know about making decisions. Nothing good ever came from a management decision. Avoid making decisions whenever possible. They can only get you in trouble. Here are some good methods for avoiding decisions while still doing stuff that appears managerish. Act confused. Form a task force of people who are too busy to meet. Send employees to find more data. Lose documents submitted for your approval. Say you're waiting for some other manager to get up to speed. The most popular method for avoiding decisions is the margin scrawl technique. Use this method when an employee leaves a document on your desk that requires a decision. In the most illegible handwriting you can generate, put little questions in the margins of the document and give it to your secretary to deliver. Here are some good examples of margin scrawl. Things that sound like, "Mlun yo ak," or "Arunt ya alumnyak nab ya," or my favorite, "Pun ya ribak." Your employee will be stunned and infuriated by this response. But since you're never available to clarify your comments, the employee will embark on an absurd odyssey to find answers to your questions. This can take months. And when the employee tries again, you can repeat the process with this scrawl, Ya bleu ni bois, and add lots of question marks and exclamation marks. The exclamation marks show that you're getting angry and warns the employee not to submit another unclear request. Trust is an important asset for a leader to have. That might be a problem if you're a huge, unscrupulous weasel bent on abusing your position of power for personal gain. Fortunately, there's a tool for leaders like you, too. It's called lying. Lying isn't a good idea in non-work situations because bad things can happen if you get caught. But when you're dealing with employees, they have few retaliatory options as long as you keep the supply cabinet locked. And if you lose trust, you can always use fear and intimidation to get the same results. There's no real risk. Leadership can best be understood by the Alaskan dog sled analogy. It takes several dogs to haul one human in a sled. But if those dogs wisely threaten to bite the human, then that one human can haul many dogs riding comfortably in the sled. Leadership is like that, except without the dogs and the sled and the frozen tundra. I don't know what a tundra is, but I'm pretty sure you wouldn't want yours frozen. Leadership skills are quite different than management skills. When you manage, by definition, you're trying to distribute resources where they will do the company the most good. When you lead, by definition, you're trying to get those resources distributed to yourself. Obviously, leadership is a better way to go. It's easier, too. Always lead by example. Let's say you're trying to reduce costs in the company. You can set an example by ordering your chauffeur to get his hair cut at Supercuts. This is the kind of personal sacrifice that inspires the employees. Soon, you'll be able to squeeze their health benefits like a tourniquet on a seedless grape. You can also agree to share a secretary with another leader to reduce costs. You might have to work that secretary 80 hours a week until the secretary is bitter and unattractive to look at, but when you make personal sacrifices like this, it's contagious. Before long, every employee will be willing to take a bullet for you, and if they aren't, just grab one by the arm and pull him in front of you at the last minute. It all works out the same, bullet-wise. Leadership isn't only about selfish actions. Don't get me wrong. It's also about empty, meaningless expressions. Here are a few you should memorize. Work smarter, not harder. It's a new paradigm. It's an opportunity, not a problem. The whole concept of leadership involves getting people to do things that they don't want to do. The trick is to convince employees that they will feel good if they do these things, not in the sense of having adequate food and shelter, but in the sense that their hearts and souls will be nourished. Fortunately, their egos are so beaten down that they're like goats trying to munch tin cans, willing to digest any ridiculous thing that you feed them. You can use these ego-stroking messages to inspire employees to work harder without extra money. You're a valued member of the team. Nobody can do the things you can do. You're helping make the world a better place. If the employee continues to whine about being paid less than a Uruguayan gnat farmer, that dissatisfaction must be caused by some deep character flaw they invariably seem to have. And that's not your problem. You're busy leading. You can't be a psychiatrist, too. One of your jobs as a manager is to identify and promote new managers. Ideally, each new manager should be less qualified than you. Otherwise, that new manager will try to take your job or make you look dumb. It's in your best interest to keep the talent pool as thin as possible, just as the people who promoted you have done, until eventually the only creatures getting promoted are single-cell organisms. When we are born, all humans are clueless, self-absorbed, and helpless. Most babies will grow out of it. Those who don't become managers. But adults with management potential are sometimes hard to spot. As a manager yourself, look for these telltale signs of high potential management candidates. Number 1. When you sit down suddenly, you crush their heads. Number 2. They get whiplash from nodding vigorously while you talk. Number 3. They mimic your mannerisms and appearance in such detail that you can use them as a mirror to locate and remove bits of food from your teeth. Now let's turn our attention to motivating employees, starting with forced interaction with unpleasant people. An excellent way to make employees glad they're alive is to force them to spend more time with their bosses and coworkers. For example, you could form a company bowling team and use subtle pressure to coerce people to participate. With a bowling team, you can combine the joy of being overexposed to annoying coworkers with the thrill of wearing used shoes. As your bowling team wallows in the entrails of defeat at the hands of your laughing and talented opponents, the employees will learn new things about each other and about life itself. Unfortunately, much of what they learn about life will cause them to wish it were over sooner, but eventually they will learn how to accept defeat, not as individuals, but as a collection of coworkers who resent each other. That will cut down on the idle chatter during the day. Despite all the prattle you hear from your employees about wanting more money, greater dignity, and shorter hours, what they really want is interesting work. The more the better. But remember, what might seem boring to you as a seasoned manager is actually quite fascinating to the employees. There's no point in taking some perfectly interesting job, such as accounts payable clerk, and trying to make it more interesting than it already is. Just make it harder. That's practically the same thing. Employees thrive on challenge. Give them as many artificial challenges as possible. For example, you could ask them for frequent presentations and status reports until the employees have no time left to actually work. That's exactly the kind of challenge they're looking for. When you have an exceptionally nasty project, present it to your employee as a challenge. That seemingly minor change in syntax will cause the employee to feel like an Olympic athlete instead of the boot-stomped carpet mite that he is. Words matter. Another good technique is empty promises of promotions. It can be expensive to promote an employee, but it costs you nothing to promise a promotion at some undefined future time. That way, you get all of the motivational benefits without any of the costs. When the future arrives, and believe me, it often does, the employee will complain that the promotion has not materialized. That means it's time for the team leader scam. Sometimes you can fool an employee into thinking he's been promoted. Designate him as team leader, and assure him that his salary is higher than that of the other people in the group. As team leader, he won't have access to the personnel files, so there's no way to disprove your claim. This method costs you nothing and has the added advantage that the team leader will do much of your job in addition to his own. Employees can also be motivated by a chance to meet a vice president. Employees believe that company vice presidents are unscrupulous, incompetent, uncaring turds. Needless to say, employees are delighted by the opportunity to spend some time with them. That's why a powerful motivational incentive is to promise you'll give your employees exposure to senior management as a reward for doing a good job. Employees think exposure is a good thing. They eat it up. They fantasize about the executive, noticing the special twinkle in their eye and the wisdom of their words. They imagine the executive begging them to become a special advisor. Imagine this fantasy scene. Employee: I was thinking we should have a bigger parking lot. Vice President: My God, that's an incredible idea. I'll order it done. Employee: It was nothing. I've got lots of them. Vice President: From now on, I won't make a move without consulting you first. Employee: I'm blushing. It's important that employees have objectives. Ask your employees to participate in the creation of their own objectives. This process is called buy-in, and it can be very amusing to watch. Ask each employee to write up a set of objectives that seem appropriate. The smarter employees will invent fun and unmeasurable objectives like these. Scan periodicals to determine important trends that affect our industry. Acquire state-of-the-art technology and investigate the internet for strategically important information. Or, attend trade shows and conventions in sunny, low-crime areas in order to network with important clients. Or, act as advisor emeritus on all important projects. The employee naturally expects you to toughen the objectives and also make them a bit more measurable. It's a natural process of give and take that eventually leads to a well-defined consensus, i.e., buy-in. At the end, you should have a set of objectives that have this level of specificity and measurability. Build a computer operating system that will give the company monopoly control over all computing in the solar system by the fourth quarter. This new operating system must run under Windows 95. Create daily status reports that increase the profits of the company by 20%. Construct a new sales office using only your body as tools. Reduce customer complaints by 150% through any means necessary, including but not limited to violence. Discover oil in your cubicle. Most of all, have fun. That last objective is there to show that you care. At some future point, typically while the objectives are coming out of the printer, the environment will change and the objectives will become moot. Rather than rewrite the objectives for every little shift in direction, you can verbally assure the employee that the objectives will be mentally adjusted in your mind. You won't believe the calm and reassured look you'll get when you tell an employee that his objectives have been adjusted in your mind. His eyebrows will wrinkle and he'll start to wring his little hands and shift in his seat. He might start updating his resume right in front of you. You don't have to be an expert in body language to know that those are all signs of trust. By the time the actual review period is up, you will be transferred to another group to manage. Don't worry about the employees that you left behind. Company policy says that you must complete the performance reviews of the employees in your old department, but that policy is only meant to keep the employees motivated. It's not something you actually have to do. However, you will be asked to review the employees in your newly inherited group. You'll have no idea what they've done all year, but that won't matter, because their objectives will be moot by that time anyway. Blame the previous manager for not giving you any feedback, and say you've got a call in. Keep that up until you're transferred again and the trail grows cold. If for some reason you stay in one job for too long, you may be forced to do a performance review and assign raises. Begin by asking the employees to write their own performance review. This may seem irrational to them, since ultimately they're not going to have any say about their own rating, and it might seem like they're doing your job for you. Those concerns can be eliminated by pretending to care. Naturally, the employees will complain that they can't rate themselves against objectives that have become moot during the year. Instruct them to invent some after-the-fact objectives based on what they actually did and then rate their performance on those objectives. At that point, the employee will be seriously questioning whether you're worth all the oxygen you're consuming on Earth. But rather than deal with the philosophical question, they will delight in the opportunity to exaggerate their accomplishments in the hope of getting a large pay increase. They are funny that way. You might feel somewhat trapped by the fact that the employees will rate themselves godlike on every single objective. That would seem to indicate a big pay increase. You have two strategies for foiling them. Number one, explain that although they exceeded their objectives, the objectives themselves were not very important to the company. Your policy is to reward only the people who make a difference. Number two, explain that although their performance is indeed impressive, it has been a very difficult year for the company, and so everybody gets about the same size tiny raise. Then there's the performance evaluation. The annual performance evaluation is your most valuable motivational tool. The only downside is that it might require you to talk to your employees more than once a year. But don't worry, you can usually count on moving to a new assignment before that's necessary. Your objective is to convince each employee that his performance review is a measure of his performance. In reality, of course, the performance review only measures your ability to predict changes in the environment that are inherently unpredictable. But experience shows that if you explain it that way to the employees, they get all cynical instead of motivated. You must use your awesome powers of persuasion to make them think the environment is a predictable fixed point and only their performance is variable. It would be nice if employees would work at their maximum level of performance without any prodding. But as you might have noticed, employees are lazy and selfish unless you apply modern management techniques. The three keys to obtaining higher employee productivity are, number one, slogans, number two, threats, and number three, mandatory unpaid overtime. I don't mean to imply that you can achieve higher productivity simply by creating a slogan. You also have to have the slogan put on a big banner on the wall. That shows that you mean business. If you don't go the extra mile, your employees will not realize how committed you are to making them do extra work for free. Threats are an excellent way to increase productivity. To illustrate my point, let's say you drop two scuba divers in shark-infested waters at the same time. One diver is motivated by a desire to be the best shark avoider that he can be. The other diver is motivated by the fear of being eaten. Which one will swim faster? Actually, it doesn't matter, because neither diver can outswim a great white shark. so they'll both become chums if you catch my sea drift. So the point of my story is that if you want productivity, don't hire scuba divers, hire sharks. The sharks are faster, and they never whine about compensation. There are many hours in the day that get wasted because employees insist on eating, sleeping, and procreating. You can reduce those unproductive periods by forcing them to work unpaid overtime. But don't refer to it as unpaid overtime. Refer to it as a commitment to professionalism or some other noble-sounding name. Never, ever refer to it as, "Ha ha ha, you're working hard for nothing!" That would be demotivating. Employees might seem to be more creative when they work long hours, but don't worry about that threat. It's not really creativity, it's only dementia. Dementia is similar to creativity, but without the expensive art supplies. Creativity can cause no end of trouble in your company, whereas dementia can help keep salary expenses in check. It's a fine line, but you can tell the difference by looking at the ears of your employees. If an ear is pierced several times, that's creativity, a sign of trouble. But if an ear is missing entirely, that's dementia. That's good. If you hate your employees, or you want them to resign without a severance package, let them know by sending them to mandatory team-building exercises. The best ones are the ones that could result in death or dismemberment. Team-building is more than just a way to reduce headcount. It also allows employees to learn about each other in a way that will increase productivity. For example, when an employee sees that coworkers are incompetent, not just on the job, but at a whole range of artificial team-building challenges, the employee will abandon any hope of getting help back at the office. This cuts down on meetings, thus improving productivity. You can also improve motivation by offering to remove obstacles that block the employee's success. This won't be easy, since the problem is usually you, and any problems that aren't your fault tend to be so large that you couldn't fix them if you tried. The best solution is to promise to remove obstacles and later say that you tried, but somebody didn't return your calls. Alternately, you could report that you used up all your chips trying to make it happen. Every company should have an employee rejection plan. Your employees are a rich source of ideas that would make you look like a moron for not thinking of the ideas yourself. They will insist on sharing these ideas with you. It is not motivating to respond by beating them with a knick-knack from your credenza. Instead, you want to maintain their fevered pitch of motivation by designing a program to systematically reject their ideas. You can call the program the Employee Suggestion Plan to disguise your true intent. Offer cash rewards for ideas so the employees will feel like part of a family, assuming they come from a family of prostitutes. The program should be designed to route all suggestions to the person who should have thought of the idea in the first place. That person can deny cash payment to the suggester for one of these foolproof reasons. Number one, I thought of that exact same idea yesterday. Great minds think alike. Or number two, it won't work because, insert illogical reason that shows a lack of comprehension about the idea, thanks for your suggestion. You should know how to set priorities. When one of your lazy employees asks you to set priorities, it is a devious trick to avoid doing whatever you rank lowest. You can thwart that transparent maneuver by ranking all assignments as top priorities. Later, if an assignment doesn't get done, you can blame the employee for not working on the highest priorities. It's that simple. If the lazy employee whines that priorities should be ranked differently, you can smooth those ruffled feathers by becoming noticeably angry. If you have to fake anger, use these simple tricks. If you're male, reach below your desk and squeeze your testicles until your face becomes flushed and your eyes bulge. If you're female, think about the fact that the male managers are sitting at their desks, squeezing their testicles, and getting paid more than you are. The result will be similar. If your employees think that you're less effective than a cardboard hammer, you can correct that misperception through a technique called micromanagement. Micromanagement is part attitude and part action. First, the attitude. Tell yourself that every one of your employees is dumber than a Yugo full of anvils. They need your help. Then, the action. Pitch in to give your employees helpful guidance on every little thing they do, from paragraph indentation to complex microchip design theory. Micromanagement is especially effective when applied to your employees' written work. It is easy to improve documents that have been created by your illiterate and untalented staff members. But if you can't find any obvious errors, here are a few upgrades that will allow you to display your value. Number one, your periods aren't thick enough. See if you can thicken them. Number two, work the phrase proactive synergies into it a few times. Number three, see if you can get it all on one page. And number four, you use the letter E way too much. It's unprofessional. Document micromanagement is most effective when there's a tight deadline and the document takes hours to print. That gives the employee time to fully appreciate your contribution. Micromanagement can also be applied to technical decisions. Let's say, for example, your employee has a master's degree in electrical engineering from Stanford University. And let's say that you almost graduated from Ernie's College-O-Rama with a degree in art history. In this context, almost graduated refers to the fact that you considered applying, but you didn't have any postage stamps. You can use your superior education, combined with your impenetrable logic, to find and correct the mistakes of your worthless employee, thus demonstrating your value. In our hypothetical situation, the employee might complain bitterly that your unfamiliarity with the subject matter is causing you to make bad decisions, but you can quickly dissipate the tension through a process called intimidation. Micromanagement is risk-free as long as you have the power to assign blame to the innocent. If your galactic incompetence ends up micromanaging a perfectly good project into a swamp, blame the closest employee for not speaking up sooner. Sometimes you won't have any pressing problems in your department, at least none that you're choosing to acknowledge. When this situation arises, the employees will get all weak and puffy and lose the rhino and quicksand work ethic that you'd like them to have. You can remedy that situation by creating a false sense of urgency. Your desk is an excellent place to age work that isn't due for a few weeks. When the deadline has passed, dole out the assignment to any employee who is not already more tense than a cat on water skis. Make sure that you point out how urgent the assignment is and that it's already past due. To get the full effect, ask to see the employee's response to the assignment before it is submitted. Then let it sit on your desk for another week. It's that final week of aging that makes all the difference. Another good way to create a false sense of urgency is to exaggerate the capabilities of your competitors. Your employees will believe that the competitors are fearsome because incompetence viewed from a distance always looks better than the incompetence that surrounds you. No matter how stupid and ineffective your competitors are, they will look like Ivy League underwear models compared to the assemblage of ugly dolts in your company. This will inspire your employees to greater effort, albeit primarily directed toward trying to get a job with a competitor. If your employees normally wear business clothes, you can motivate them by establishing a casual day on Fridays. The corporate definition of casual has three related parts. Number one, clothes that make you look neither attractive nor professional. Number two, clothes you don't own. Number three, clothes that make your ass look flat. Blue jeans, sneakers, and shorts are specifically excluded because they are comfortable and attractive, and everybody owns them. As any seasoned investor knows, any of the forbidden clothes can lead to a decline in shareholder value. Customers care about that kind of thing. Here's a shopping tip for you. When you shop for a new computer, always ask what kind of clothes are worn by the manufacturer's employees. If you don't like what you hear, move on. Although there are no scientific studies to support the connection between forbidden clothing and total economic collapse, it's just common sense. At best, forbidden clothes lead to bad decisions. At worst, global warming. Don't let that be in your conscience. Managers have to understand competition. When it comes to competition, knowledge is power, and all management knowledge comes from two sources. Number one, hackneyed sayings, such as knowledge is power, and number two, logic. Hackneyed sayings are the foundations upon which we can apply logic, thus allowing us to understand the world in more depth. For example, let's examine three hackneyed sayings, i.e., unquestionable facts, and see where the logic leads us. Unquestionable fact number one. Competition is healthy. Number two, when you have your health, you have everything. And number three, you only hurt the ones you love. Now, logically, since competition is healthy, and when you have your health, you have everything, it follows that when you have competition, you have everything. And when you have everything, nobody else can have anything, because you have it all. Therefore, if anybody wants something, they have to beg you for it. And when you make people beg, it hurts their pride. And since we know that we only hurt the ones we love, then logically, it must be true that competition makes us love everyone. To summarize this chain of logic, competition equals health, equals everything, equals begging, equals hurt, equals love. So in order to generate as much love as possible, you need plenty of competition. If the wimpy companies in your industry don't give you as much as you need, compensate by creating internal competition among your employees. It's easy. Give one employee an assignment during a meeting, then, during another meeting, give the same assignment to another employee without mentioning the duplication. It's a good idea to establish a reputation for being quirky and irrational ahead of time. I recommend biting the head off an intern in front of witnesses. When the two employees realize what you've done, they will try to ask you to clarify their roles. Tell them to work it out, then scowl as though it's their fault for not acting empowered.